Welcome everyone here to St Andrews on the Terrace. I'm Susan Jones, I'm the Senior Minister here, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you here to this place where open and honest debate is what we do, sometimes in the middle of the church service as well. So it's lovely that you're here. I might just say that our banners, which are up today for the first time, signal the beginning of Creation Month for September, which seems like a good lead-up topic to be considering while we debate what our country will do on the 23rd. So it's my pleasure to welcome you here and to tell you that this is an earthquake-strengthened building, and so you are safe here. And if an earthquake happens during the meeting of a non-political nature, duck, cover and hold and wait for further instructions. If there's a fire, the exit here and the exit that you, well, the entrance you came in is the fire exit, and please leave the building and assemble in the car park, which is out there in the dark and wet. So let's hope there's not a fire. The loos are there and most quickly reached up these steps, but you're not going to want to do that. So go out the back of the building, turn left along the footpath and then left up the temporary alleyway. You'll find yourself in the foyer and the loos are round to the right if you need them. So I hope that has you feeling relaxed and comfortable. It's great, great pleasure for me to introduce Philippa Tolley, moderator for the evening. Philippa is the executive producer of Radio New Zealand National's award-winning weekly current affairs documentary Insight, where she makes the documentaries herself and commissions and oversees the work of others. Before taking that role, she worked at Radio New Zealand International, covering events and stories in the Pacific region. At the same time, she compiled and presented World Watch for part of the week. Prior to that, Philippa worked in London for the BBC as a senior producer on national news programmes in both radio and television, after starting out at Radio New Zealand straight out of university. Philippa is also an experienced trainer, delivering courses and workshops for international organisations such as the Asia Broadcasting Union, the Commonwealth Broadcasting Association, and the Pacific Islands Forum. So we're going to be well moderated this evening. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Philippa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hello and welcome everybody here tonight. An interesting night for those who've been flicking on their phones and checking out interesting poll results. So the election is continuing to be as fascinating as it's unfolded in the last week or so. The questions for tonight's panel have come from a series of events talking about big issues leading into the election, which is now just over 3 weeks away. While our leaders can and do use all kinds of media to talk to the voters, there's nothing like being able to ask questions yourself. So you'll be able to do that after some discussion previously. There will be about 15 minutes at the end for that question time, but we only have not too much time, so we better get straight into it. Our guest tonight, Chris Finlayson. He entered Parliament in 2006, and at various stages of his career has been a branch, electorate and regional chair of the National Party. He continues to sit on the Rules Committee of the National Party and as the chairman of the Policy Consultation Committee. Chris was appointed Attorney General, Minister for Treaty of Waitangi Negotiations, and Minister for Arts, Culture and Heritage following the 2008 election. He was reappointed to these positions in 2011 and was also made the Associate Minister of Māori Affairs. After the 2014 election, Chris again was reappointed to all those positions and had another couple added in, the Minister in charge of the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service and the Minister responsible for the GCSB. We're also joined this evening by Julianne Genter, who grew up in Los Angeles but moved here to study at Auckland University Planning Practice and then worked in that area of planning. She also worked as a political and media advisor at Parliament before becoming an MP in 2011. She's a Green Party spokesperson for health, including ACC, transport, Auckland issues, youth, associate finance and sports and recreation. We're also joined this evening by Saab Johel, who's a Labour-less candidate. Saab has dedicated his career to mental health and well-being for over 25 years in both New Zealand and the UK, including specialist work in clinical psychology and disaster mental health. He's deeply concerned about the state of mental health in New Zealand and the well-being of our families, children, parents, and vulnerable and marginalised people, and he works in the area of children. And we're also joined tonight by Jeff Simmons, who is the co-deputy leader for the Opportunities Party and the candidate for Wellington Central. Jeff Simmons is an economist working for the Morgan Foundation, an independent foundation which aims to stimulate debate on the important issues facing New Zealand. You're saying you used to work as an economist for the Morgan Foundation. Jeff graduated from Auckland University with an honours degree in economics. He has over 10 years' experience as an economist for New Zealand Treasury and as a manager in the UK Civil Service. He has co-authored 4 books alongside Gareth Morgan, covering topics such as health, fishing, Antarctica, and food. So, the topics for tonight. Inequality. It's something that we've heard of frequently. We hear about housing, we hear about the growing divide in New Zealand society. Certainly housing is the very crux of this in many of the debates. If I could ask you, Chris Finlayson, with housing being one crucial aspect of inequality, and people have suggested so many options for it, such as changing zoning, changing the rules, making other people be a bit more flexible to accommodate those in need of housing. Do you think this is something that should be enforced?
Oh, yes, I do. There's no one quick fix. New Zealand's population is growing. There are issues that need to be addressed. Some people, and one of the questions suggested, do we need greater density of housing? Well, that could well be the case. My favourite city is actually Vienna, where housing is reasonably dense. But on the other hand, if people want their individual house, then it should be made of, they should have the opportunity to do it, which brings one back to the RMA and the need for greater flexibility. So long as we don't have Glasgow-like tenements, I'm very happy if people want to go up. I live in Kate Shepherd Apartments, which is about 10 stories high. I think we have to be flexible.
How do you make people, though, adopt that sense of a greater good? We all know about the sort of NIMBY attitude.
Oh, well, I think it's probably there anyway. I think some of these changes are occurring gradually, and one can see it in Wellington over the last 15, 20 years. There is a real move, for example, to more apartment dwellings. The same would apply in Auckland. So I don't think you need to sort of dragoon people into doing these things. This is not Maoist China. But I see a lot of these things happening now.
And do you see housing as at the crux of some of the inequality in New Zealand?
I think housing is an issue that needs to be confronted, and we have dealt with a number of issues over the years. Most recently, this morning, we've had an announcement recognising that homelessness is a real problem that needs to be addressed, and the Minister of Social Housing made a number of announcements in relation to that.
Thank you. We could turn to Jeff. When it comes to inequality, how significant is housing?
Housing is the number one issue in terms of inequality over the last decade or two. It's certainly driving, it's the driving force behind the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. The rich are getting richer because of rising house prices, and the poor are getting poorer because of higher rental costs. So it's after housing income that is actually declining amongst those the poorest parts of society.
So whenever a change is suggested, there are different reactions from different parts of society. How do you convince people to act in the best interests of all?
Well, I mean, obviously New Zealand has holds housing quite dear, but people need to understand that we are quite unusual in having little or no taxes on housing. We're a total outlier in the world in that respect, and it should be no surprise that we have some of the greatest levels of investment in housing and therefore some of the highest house prices in the world. So I think we need to talk about these issues more and show people that this is not only a cause of inequality, but it's also a driver of our poor economic performance because we've got so much of our money tied up in bricks and mortar.
Is there any sign of New Zealand moving past self-interest when it comes to that?
Well, I think the conversation has moved a long way in the past few years. We are now starting to conversations about capital gain taxes are becoming commonplace. That's not going to solve the problem alone. That's why, I think more and more people are talking about, asset taxes or land value taxes, and I think, that will slowly infect the public debate.
All right. Moving over to this side, if I could hand that to you, maybe Saab, could it? So, housing, again, for you, central to inequality, or is there something else that should be tackled first?
I think it's one of the central issues around inequality. If I can maybe reflect on my own experience, I think it's not just the housing that's present, but it's also the standard of housing that we're living in. So growing up in the UK myself, my parents moved over from Punjab. They were refugees during the partition. And when they moved over to the UK, it was very different housing to them. They lived in very poor quality housing. And I remember I was about 8 years old, and the transformative experience that we had when we actually managed to get double glazing in so that we could actually use more than one room in the house. And then we can actually get that heated too. We actually managed to get central heating put into the house too. And that changed our lives. So the standard of housing that we have in New Zealand is shockingly poor for many of those people who are living in them. So as well as building more houses, there needs to be a real program of work upgrading the houses that people are already living in. And I think that this is an intergenerational issue, because I think that people carry on living in these sorts of houses, and we have, unfortunately, low expectations around what housing should be. There was just a news story on the way here where there's an old campground that's being used for emergency accommodation, and they were saying that there are no carpets in most houses in New Zealand, and it's acceptable for it to be a concrete floor. That's not acceptable. If you look at the respiratory rates of disease that we have for children and adults in New Zealand, it's up there in the OECD. It's not a figure that we should be proud of.
So when it comes to actually action, a lot of people would look at the standards and say not acceptable, but we have this problem. There's a lot of resistance to some of the changes that are being suggested. How do you overcome that resistance within New Zealand society? How do you get a sense of a collective way to move forward?
Yeah, I think that there are some settings that we could be looking at. So thinking about, is it fair that that there is big capital inflow into New Zealand, which inflates housing prices? So it's not necessarily the number of transactions, but it's the amount of money that comes in. So that changes the game for people who are trying to acquire good housing. So thinking about, what is it that's required to make the housing market a little bit more of a level playing field, such that it's not ratcheting out of reach for many people? So I think we could collectively come together and make a decision around the importance of housing here in New Zealand for New Zealanders, and whether it's okay for people who have no stake in New Zealand to come in and to inflate our housing prices.
Thank you. We can move to Julianne. Obviously, for the Greens, this has been inequality has been a major focus of what's been happening in elections so far. When it comes to housing and the state of the housing stock that Saab's been talking about, how many houses we've got for people to live in, what are the main things that need to change for you?
I think that there's a huge opportunity with housing, with transport, with urban development to create towns and cities that are healthier, happier, better for the climate, and more affordable. And that's one of the reasons I was inspired enough to get involved in politics, because our built environment in New Zealand could be so much better. It's entirely within the power of central and local government to change it. And I think the four key things are, addressing the issue with foreign capital. The Greens have long said if you're going to buy real estate in New Zealand, you should be a citizen or a resident. We have to fix the tax system, and the Greens have been campaigning on a capital gains tax since 2002. I think there's other options as well that we need to look at.
But we know things like the capital gains tax, there's a lot of resistance to some of these things.
The interesting thing is there's not as much resistance as there used to be. So back in 2002, there was the opportunity to do it, but it wasn't politically popular, so the government of the day didn't do it. But these days, I think it is much more accepted that it's something that should play a role in our tax system. The third thing is we need to have protection for renters and better building standards, more in a fitness for rental properties, but even higher standards for new builds. And the final thing is just government actually needs to be more involved in building homes. And that is an opportunity as well to raise the standard of building, because government, if it didn't have such narrow financial ways of assessing what government was doing, like Housing New Zealand at the moment is required to pay a dividend back to the Crown, what we really need it to do is to deliver on those wider social, environmental objectives. And it can even deliver on more economic objectives by being almost like the Kiwi Bank of the banking sector, you know, of the building sector. So we have a Kiwi Bank that's there competing with the big four Aussie banks. We need a public sector developer that's there competing with the private developers, but delivering on those objectives that are better for the community, and that will drive improvements in the private sector.
When you're out campaigning, do you feel there's a gap between what lots of people would say was, you know, a moral imperative to provide people with a warm, safe home, and practically what they're prepared to accept when it comes to policies?
Maybe I'm just an optimist, but I feel that most New Zealanders I speak to really embrace the policy solutions that we're talking about. And I think what's happened is that for some time, the political leadership hasn't been acting in the interests of wider New Zealand or along the values of wider New Zealand. They've been acting really preserving the status quo for those who have benefited from it. And so I think we have an opportunity, because we have MMP, to choose much more representative group of leaders who could bring the public along with us on this journey, which I think that most New Zealanders want. And I think that's going to be reflected in the election results.
Well, we might get some questions about this afterwards. But if we can move on to another topic which has been incredibly to the forefront of people's minds during the election, and that's water and the general ecology and the situation that's facing, I suppose, New Zealand's environment. I suppose if I could ask Saba, if you wouldn't mind handing the microphone back. And Al Jazeera, I think, has just started running a documentary talking about paradise polluted. You know, that's how New Zealand is being framed on that particular television channel at the moment. You know, how much is the ecological crisis at the centre of what needs to be done in, I suppose, marketing New Zealand, making sure New Zealand's sustainable, or is it something that's sort of nice to have and it runs alongside?
No, my view is that it's critical. We derive two big industries are dairying, primary industry, and also tourism. And both of those are integrally involved in how it is that we use water, how we use that precious resource. So unless we take action and steps to make sure that we do limit the damage that's being put upon our water systems, our rivers, and what that looks like from an external point of view, but also for New Zealanders wanting to enjoy that resource, but also use that resource too. You know, I'm also reminded, my day job is I'm an associate professor in disaster mental health, and I think about climate change a lot. And I think about the impact that that's going to have upon our rainfall patterns and where we get the rain and the implications of that for our power, for dairying, for tourism. All these things are integrally around, involved with the water that we have and how we use it. And there are other issues that are coming up on the horizon as well, such as deep seabed mining. You know, I'm concerned about the impact that may have upon our coastlines as well. There are unforeseen impacts around the damage to habitats, but also pollution that may come from that too. So I think that we do need to actively manage our waterways and our water resources a lot more than we are. And that's why we're proposing a levy on the usage of water, to make sure that when water is used, that we have the resources in place to make sure, and we have incentives in place to make sure that that water is used wisely, and it contributes to the cleaning up of our waterways too.
We also know we've got things, you know, thousands of birds, animals and plants, you know, on the threatened list. You know, what else needs to be done?
I think we need to take a much wider strategic view upon the centrality of water to our life, our national life. So I do think that we need to have a wider debate upon the use of water and the ecology there.
Is it all about water? Are there other things?
Well, water's central to everything. It's central to our power. It's central to how it is that we frame ourselves as New Zealanders. You know, one of the best things that I have in my life when I try to describe it to other people is how central water is to my life. I didn't learn to swim until I was 12. I didn't learn to swim properly until I was swimming with dolphins in Kaikoura when I was 30. That's what motivated me to actually engage in my life as a New Zealander. And so I think it's central to our identity, and I think that we've been neglecting it for far too long.
Thank you. If I could turn to Chris Finlayson. So over the time National has been leading government, a number of changes, a number of policies and legislation has been introduced. You know, how much more needs to be done, and should it be made more core to economic policy to preserve the environment?
Well, I've been very involved in precisely this area as Minister of Treaty Negotiations. In terms of settlements with individual iwi, a lot of money has been put into various river systems. I can think of the Kaituna, the Rangitaiki, the Waikato, the Manawatu, most recently the groundbreaking new structure for the Whanganui River. So there's a recognition that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in these rivers. Take the Whanganui, for example. It's going to be impossible in the short term to turn back the clock, but the Tongariro power development has had a profound effect on that river. And so to restore is going to take time. We will not reach the New Jerusalem in 5 minutes.
As you say, a lot of our waterways have continued. The standards of the quality has declined, while some of it's historic. Does more urgent action need to be taken to address it, even if it's not something you can solve overnight?
Well, there is very solid action that is being taken, and again, there's a very real effort that I see in terms of riparian planting, and it's I know it's fashionable to knock agriculture, but I've seen some of the work done by farmers, for example, along the banks of the Whanganui River, and there's a very real effort to address these problems and make sure that particular farming patterns do not interfere unduly with the river or cause more damage. But the fact of the matter is that the Waikato and the Waipa, two rivers I know very well through my treaty negotiations, took about 80 years to get to that state, and it's going to be a long twilight struggle to bring them back. It cannot be done in 5 minutes.
We all know how important the agricultural sector, dairying, is to the New Zealand economy, but do you feel that the environment is in the heart of New Zealand society, that it's something that people are really passionate about and really want more to be done?
Oh, look, I totally agree with you. It was the National Government that had the first Minister for the Environment almost 50 years ago, Duncan McIntyre, who the environment defines very much who we are, and to say that one
Have
political party
debate?
Has a monopoly on virtue when it comes to this issue is simply wrong. All parties, I would say, are committed to the issue. We disagree on the particular mechanisms.
So you don't feel that it needs to be brought further to the fore?
Well, I think it is about as far forward as it's a tier one issue. It's got to be addressed. And this government has been addressing it in a variety of ways. I've described the work that I've done as Minister of Treaty Negotiations in terms of co-governance arrangements. I have profound problems with the idea of a levy and paying a royalty to iwi. I think that could open up a whole can of problems. Happy to talk about it at any time.
All right, thank you. If I could just turn to Julian Gentle. We obviously, at the Green Party, we know this is at, you know, the very core of the Green Party. But if I could turn it on its head, though, is, you know, the policies and the proposals that it would come from your party, how much do you have to factor in the economic well-being of New Zealand? And, you know, the dairy is one of our biggest industries.
I think the source of the problem with ecological devastation in New Zealand and the world more generally is the idea that somehow the economy is separate to the environment, when it's not. I mean, all the economy is people, their time, their energy, their ideas, that they're making things and trading things and using natural resources. If we don't manage our natural resources responsibly, we won't have an economy. If we don't invest in people, if they're not healthy and happy and looked after, we don't have an economy. The idea that the economy is this machine over there that we need to keep ticking over and the high priests of the economists are the only ones who understand it, I think we've all been duped, really. And the reality is that there will be no life on Earth if we don't start living in a more responsible way. And that is, but it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to improve our own lives. All of us enjoy being in the natural environment, and we could have jobs that are about cleaning it up and restoring it. We could have jobs that are about looking after people and making sure that they are able to achieve their highest potential. And so when it comes to dairy in New Zealand, I don't think New Zealand has done very well out of dairy. I think that the cost has been far too high, that the profits have not been spread equitably across all New Zealanders, and that it's been completely unsustainable to double the number of cows in New Zealand over the last 8 years. So we have to be realistic about that. But we also have to have a managed transition, and we have to show those people who are currently earning their livelihood in this particular way that there is another path. And that, I think, is government's responsibility to work with people. It's almost like relationship counseling. The Greens and farmers need to stop looking at each other as the problem and say, actually, New Zealand and farmers, we have a problem together. How are we going to solve it together?
Right. Jeff Simmons. Have we got it wrong with dairy? Has it given to New Zealand all that, you know, it said it's given?
No. And this is the... I kind of agree with Julianne, and I kind of don't. I mean, the intensification in dairy that we've seen over the last decade hasn't actually delivered that much in terms of profits, because we put extra cows on the land, but we have increased costs at the same time through palm kernel, through fertilizer, through water. And actually, a lot of farmers are no better off than they were 10 years ago. So why in hell did we do it? Well, partly Fonterra and Dairy NZ are pushing for volume, but partly this is tied up with our obsession in capital gain. This is the same sickness that's driving our housing sector, is driving our farming sector too. Farmers don't farm for yield, they farm for capital gain. How do you increase your capital gain? You increase the volume that you're producing, and everyone thinks, oh, that must be a really profitable business, we'll put up the price of the land. It doesn't actually make any sense, a lot of the intensification that's happened over the last 10 years. It hasn't improved profits, and it has wrecked the environment. So there's actually a lot of people out there, probably the relationship counsellors that Julianne is talking about, people like Alison Jews, who are working with farmers and saying, actually, we can improve the environment and it won't harm your profit at all.
Yeah, and I wasn't implying that farmers were the ones profiting. I think it's been, you know, banks and the likes of Fonterra, and the decisions that are being made there aren't reflective of what's actually good for farmers or New Zealand.
The farmers who've sold their farms for capital gain have profited.
And the other big industry, of course, is tourism, and tourism is based on New Zealand's environment. So is it just about looking at agriculture? Does there need to be a wider attitude towards what's going on in the environment, whether there's an ecological crisis in New Zealand and how it impacts on our other big industry?
Absolutely, and this is why the Tourism Export Industry Council has gotten involved in the freshwater discussion and is putting their hand up and saying we need to do something about this, because they are worried about our 100% pure brand. I mean, they are seriously concerned. But I actually think there's an even bigger risk than that, Philippa. I think New Zealand has the potential, as Sir Paul Callaghan said, to be the place where talent wants to live. In a world that is destroying its environment, we have the potential to be the place where everyone in the world actually wants to live. And you know, so we don't want to go down the same path as everyone else. We want to maintain what is unique about our country.
Can I bring up one other potential solution, which is that the Green Party for a long time has had this bill that was developed by my former colleague, Dr. Kennedy Graham, called the Sustainability Indicators Bill. And what this would do is put certain indicators about ecological sustainability along 8 different planetary parameters right at the heart of Treasury and government policy making. And I think that reporting on that, paying attention to it, can help drive policy in a way that will enrich our environment rather than destroy it.
Perhaps we should give Chris Van Lessen another option to sort of say something. When it comes to tourism, obviously a huge earner for New Zealand, you know, how important is it for us to be able to maintain an environment that is still attractive for the whole world to come and visit?
Oh, self-evidently extremely important.
And are we doing that?
And, well, I think that a lot of our tourism facilities are actually stressed at the present time. I was talking to someone recently who was on the Tongariro walk, and she said it was like being in a queue. So we are in many respects victims of our own success, and that's why I've been very interested, for example, to work with Ngāti Rangatihi about developing a great Tarawera walk. We do have to grow our tourism offerings, otherwise we are going to cause greater damage to the environment. But certainly I endorse what Jeff says. Part of this country's brand is that it's clean and green, and so we have to be very jealous of that brand and make sure that we maintain high standards at all times.
So is that the answer, is to spread tourism further across New Zealand? Is there any more fundamental change needed than that?
No, I think, as I said, there are two aspects of it. It's one, that we have to make sure that we continue the sort of work that this government's been doing for the last 9 years in terms of improving the environment, but there's also in terms of, I do think we are overstressing some of our tourist facilities and there need to be more offerings. We've got, you only have to arrive in New Zealand and the customs hall in Auckland and see the number of flights that are coming in. There are lots of people who are coming to this country, and I don't think there are enough offerings, and we put what there are at risk by the kinds of pressures we're putting on them.
Thank you. Well, look, you know, you've mentioned airports. Jeff is talking about New Zealand being a place that so many people want to come and visit and to live, and we see that in the statistics that come out endlessly. Record numbers of people moving here, record numbers of visitors. But this whole immigration question is something that's been, you know, of passionate interest all around the globe, for good or for better, from Brexit to Trump, global politics seem to be trending towards nationalism and isolationism. Jeff Simmons, do you see any similar trends here?
Well, not to the same degree, I don't think, but, you know, certainly there are populist elements in New Zealand's political scene. I don't think we need to dwell on who that is.
So, your party, would you be a good international neighbour?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, we think actually Brexit and Trump are a fantastic opportunity for New Zealand to attract some of the best talent from around the world. You know, we should be out there advertising ourselves. And actually, you know, our immigration system does make it difficult for some very highly skilled entrepreneurs to come here. But the other thing I'd say about our international reputation, and it comes back to the tourism, the 100% pure thing that we were talking about before. I know a lot of diplomats, and New Zealand is well regarded around the world. We have a great international reputation. But there is this creeping view around the world that we're not quite living up to our reputation anymore. You know, and I think, you know, the 100% pure is a good example. The sorts of, you know, erosion of transparency that we're seeing in the public sector at the moment is another good example. We talk the talk overseas, but I don't think we're necessarily walking it at home, and I think that's a risk.
So what needs to change?
Well, I think we need to walk the talk, is exactly what I'm saying. You know, I think we need to.
In what way?
Well, greater transparency, you know, within New Zealand. A good example would be, you know, the Official Information Act. Some reform is definitely needed there. Making sure that public servants actually serve the public rather than ministers. You know, a good example that I know quite a bit about is that New Zealand has been at the forefront pushing for a marine reserve in Antarctica, and yet we have less than 1% of our own exclusive economic zone protected. You know, is the 100% pure thing is another good example. I think there's just lots of little examples where we're not quite doing what we say the rest of the world should be doing.
Thank you. Julian Genta. So immigration, you know, are New Zealanders becoming reticent? Are they becoming protectionist about what's here? Are we as embracing to those from other parts of the world as we were in the past?
I think there's some risk of that, but I also think that the feeling of support for Trump and even support for Brexit wasn't actually representative of the populations of those countries. I think the trend towards populist nationalism is probably somewhere between 10 and 15% of populations in most countries. And luckily, because we have MMP, it can't, you know, express itself by taking over a major party and then dominating the executive branch as it has in the United States. But I also feel quite strongly that this idea of immigration being the source of our problems is very misguided. And it's absolutely wrong. It's an easy one for people to latch onto. The reality is that wages are being eroded. Infrastructure hasn't been invested in. We do have a housing crisis. Our environment is under pressure. And all of those are failures of government policy. They're not the result of other people or new people coming to New Zealand. I mean, we have the population, I think we have half the population of the island of Manhattan in New Zealand. So there's plenty of opportunity for there to be more people here and for our towns and cities to be even greener. We need government leadership to invest in infrastructure. We need support to protect wages and to strengthen collective bargaining. We need to ensure that we're protecting our natural environment, investing in the infrastructure we need. And if we do that, more people is an opportunity. The idea that somehow there's a limited number of jobs in New Zealand, and if more people come in, they're going to steal the jobs of the existing people, that's not the case if you have good public policy.
But we were just talking at the beginning about inequality and housing. Yep. And, you know, we know that people come, they come to Auckland. Auckland is where the housing situation has been, you know, at the sharpest point. Do we need to change settings to make sure that we can cope with those that come and that it's balanced with providing for the people who are already here?
Well, we need immigrants to build more housing. I mean, we actually need people to help us build more housing. More hands make light work. The problem isn't more people, it's the fact that the current government has failed to invest sufficiently in housing. There are some issues around planning rules, and there's opportunities to allow. I mean, the big barrier, I know Chris mentioned earlier that we shouldn't force people to live in dense neighborhoods. Our planning rules have actually prevented that from happening. They've forbidden it. So simply by changing planning rules, having government leadership, building proper integrated communities, not just a bunch of standalone houses on the fringe of a city somewhere, will be an opportunity. But really, the problem isn't not enough people, it's not enough government leadership, not enough protection
Maybe
of people and environment.
Hand the microphone to Saab here. So Labor has talked about wanting to restrict some of those that are coming in here. You know, is this a reflection of pragmatism, or is it a reflecting how New Zealanders are feeling about people coming to this country?
So speaking as an immigrant myself, twice over, I guess my parents are immigrants and I'm an immigrant myself too. I think that New Zealanders have always been welcoming to me. And I think that New Zealanders are welcoming of other people. I think one of the issues is around disconnection. And the disconnection from the importance of the infrastructure that people need in order to get on with their everyday lives. But also, I think it's this modern trend around how we tend to live our lives in bubbles, quite disconnected away from each other. And I think that it speaks back to, I guess, one of the bigger themes that I know has come up here before is this idea of neoliberalism and the idea of individualism. And if we don't see ourselves connected with other people globally, then we can become quite insular in our views. I was in California when President Trump was going through his inauguration, and I would be walking and driving through back rural California, and they'd be talking about ranches for Trump. And yet you would also go through these fields and you'd see so many immigrants working upon these ranches, and they'd be voting for essentially a government that would start looking at that very carefully. And I think that there are dangers when we are caught up in these bubbles of rhetoric. And so I think what we're very clear about is that immigrants are incredibly valuable to New Zealand, but we also need to think about what is the balance here around where people are living, for a start. You know, if we've got lots of pressure going on in Auckland, then we need to be thinking much more imaginatively around encouraging people to go where there is a shortage in terms of labour, in terms of skills, and how it is that we upskill everybody who is here in New Zealand in order to continue to build a nation, which is within a wider debate around population, not just immigration. Thinking about where is the growth going to be? What is our vision for New Zealand? How do we see ourselves as a nation? How big do we see ourselves? How small do we see ourselves? And then start thinking about the settings with that context in mind, not just about immigration.
Thank you. Chris Finlayson. We know the government has changed the settings. There's been an adjustment. You know, if National was to return to government, what would be the view they were having about immigration versus how New Zealanders feel?
Well, let's be perfectly frank. We're a nation of immigrants. As I said at a meeting in Rongotai today, the first citizens of this country arrived, well, we're not quite sure, but between 800 and 1,000 years ago, and this country has been incredibly enriched by the arrival of all sorts of communities. I specifically cited the example of the Sri Lankan community and what Peter Fraser did with the Polish immigrants, the 744 kids in 1944. I think these things are very good. And if we turn off or pause immigration, as the Labour candidate for Rongotai was suggesting today, I think it would be very harmful to us, obviously economically, but also as a country. We are a country of immigrants, and we should welcome immigrants because they add to this country, they provide skills which are needed, they make us a much better and more interesting place.
So you mentioned those Polish children. What about the refugee quota? There's been a great deal of debate about that we should be changing our levels.
And we've got an obligation to be caring and compassionate, and we believe, and what we've done is increase the quota slightly, but I don't think that we want to be in a position that Germany got itself into a year or two back, and I was in both Germany and Austria, and those people there were so many hanging around railway stations and so on, it caused quite a few problems, and if people come here, we have to make sure that they're integrated so that they're able to play their part in the community. And I know the Greens would quintuple the amount of refugees. I think that would be a profoundly bad thing to do.
But Germany was accepting 800,000 refugees, and we're not even accepting 1,000. I mean, like, it's not really comparable, is it? We're suggesting we get up to 4,000, which would, you know, barely bring us in line with what Australia's doing now.
No, I've
on a per capita
didn't
basis.
Listen or you misunderstood. I said it's extremely important for us if we are to have refugees, and we should have refugees because we're an international citizen, have obligations, that we bring in people that are able, and we make sure that they are not left to their own devices, that they are properly integrated, and then they can play their part in the community as New Zealanders.
When do we look to increase it? Because we've been doing that great job of looking after those that come. We haven't changed the settings very much.
Well, I think basically, some people may disagree. I believe that the settings are basically right. I don't think it would be appropriate to have the pause, as Paul Eagle suggested, on the refugee front. I think that we've got it just about right in terms of bringing people in, making sure that we can integrate them. We've improved the quality of the Mangere Centre. There's a lot more that needs to be done there. I don't think that we are being stingy in any way.
If I can just clarify there, then the pause, as you're characterising it, is nothing to do with
what Paul said.
Paul said that is nothing to do with the refugee quota number.
Oh no, I recognise. No, yeah. I didn't actually say that. I said that the Paul's general proposition was pause immigration, not the refugee one. But I still think that that would be a monumentally foolish thing to do.
Well, I speak to my parents who have links with India and then very tied in as I am with the Indian community. And I think the other side of this is the exploitation that's happening here with people who are coming in and being actually victims of immigration agents who are taking advantage of them. They're paying thousands of dollars in India and seeing nothing of that. And some of them are actually living the equivalent of indentured lives, where they're not able to move away from the context in which they've arrived in New Zealand. So I think we really need to be looking and bearing that in mind much more carefully when we're looking at this immigration debate. These people are often here under, they've been given promises that are not fulfilled, and they're actually, some of them are in real danger. So I think that we should also be reaching out for them. So yes, there are the support services that do need to be developed and maintained for our proposal to double the refugee quota, but I think we also need to be reaching out for those immigrants who do find themselves in New Zealand with nowhere else to turn, because I think that actually they're in very dangerous situations, many of them.
All right, look, if we're just getting near to the time, and we're going to be asking questions very soon, but just briefly, I suppose, if we could just step back from the individual sort of party policies and say, besides voting, and presumably voting for your party, as you would, which is the single most important thing you would do as a citizen to assist society as a whole? If I could start with you, Sal. Just a small question.
Yeah, sure. Just a short, small question. I've got a 6-year-old daughter, and when we were in the car when she was 3 years old, we were listening to Radio New Zealand, as good news citizens do.
Well done.
and she asked me, "What's a foreign minister, Dad?" So I explained as best as I could what a foreign minister was, and so she said, "Okay, I'll do that after I've been prime minister." And I was A, amazed that she was paying attention, and B, amazed that she had this idea, this hierarchy, this just starting to form these ideas around what her place in New Zealand was, what the jobs were, and what a government was, what representation was. And if I had a wish, I'd be thinking about doing things like having an indicative vote that goes on in parallel with our general election, such that children and young people could participate and they could take the temperature as to what the issues were in their school, in their families, in their communities that they were interested in, that they cared about, and starting to grow that level of attachment, interest and engagement in the political system that is decision-making, and being participants in that decision-making process from a really young age. That's what my passion and my desire would be, to start to really think about future generations and our place in that decision-making in New Zealand.
Thank you. Chris Finlayson, so apart from doing your civil duty, voting, what do you think is the single most important thing that you would as a citizen do as part of society?
Oh, I think being involved in community activity, government can only do so much, but if you want to really rich and vibrant society, individuals and groups of individuals, be it through churches, debating societies, sporting groups, whatever, Lions, Rotary, need to be active and involved in their community. And I sometimes think that with the patterns of daily life, sometimes people have overlooked that fairly basic thing, and I don't think the community prospers as a result. So I don't think that defaulting to saying, oh, well, it's the government's responsibility to do things is necessarily the answer at all. It behoves individuals and groups of individuals to get together and change the world as well.
Thank you. Jess Simmons, if you could answer that same question.
Yeah, I'm actually with Chris on this one. I think people, you know, Kiwis are doers, and I think that's a really ingrained part of our culture, and I think actually what you do shapes who you are more than the other way around. Who you are shapes what you do. I really believe that, and I think the evidence shows that too. I mean, one of the most fulfilling things that I do is plant trees and hack weeds in the town belt on weekends, and after a hard week of work, it's you know, I walk away from that on a high, and the other people that I'm doing it with say similar things. And I really do believe that actually doing things in your local community make you feel more attached to that community, as if you, you know, that you care more.
Thank you.
I think that people have had less time for civic engagement because of, as a consequence of government policies that have resulted over 30 years of people, many people being in less, having less financial security, having to work longer hours, and in many ways being more separated from one another. And I guess for me, I think my work in urban and transport planning is really about finding those opportunities to create spaces where community can come together, and that and structuring our communities in a way where life doesn't separate us so much from our natural environment and from each other. And I guess that would be, aside from politics, that work, I think.
Thank you very much. Well, look, we've got about 10 minutes left for questions, so it would be great if people have questions. If I could just make one request, though, it is a time for questions, not a time for personal statements. But we have a roving microphone here if anybody would like to ask any of our panellists a question. The gentleman here.
Thank you. Concerning the housing crisis, there wasn't hardly anything mentioned about the possibility of alleviating it considerably through improved transport. That if you're short of houses in Auckland, it should be quite possible to live in Huntley or Narrawahia, or short of houses in Wellington, to live in Levin and easily get into your work. And while you put, well, more people live out there with improved transport, then those towns themselves are enriched and you start to solve some of the problems. So my comments, you know, your comments about that.
You're absolutely right. I think I sort of alluded to it when I talked about how we could structure our towns and cities in different ways. But if we had more commuter rail, for example, that would enable people to live in satellite cities, and that's what happens. But if we put all the transport budget into a few highways, and if we have this model of single houses, on subdivided onto paddocks, then it doesn't make it easier for people to live further away. They have higher transport costs, even if they have cheaper houses. So really, this people-oriented approach to transport investment will also help us with affordable transport and housing.
Shall we ask Chris Finlayson to respond as
well? I wonder what we've been doing over the last 9 years. The Kapiti Expressway is a very good example. Victory has 1,000 fathers, JFK said. Defeat is an orphan. The number of people who opposed the Kapiti Expressway and now praise it as a very good means of transport. The amount of money we've put into rolling stock so that more and more people are coming down from Waikanae, the kinds of trends you're talking about are in fact happening now. And so we don't sit back and say, well, that's all splendid, we've achieved our aim, there's a lot more to do, but that is happening now. And I know that there in some circles is a general revulsion about the issue of roads, but it is still a very important mode of transport, whether one likes it or not.
No, sorry, you can't.
Well, all the Rons have done is shifted the queue to Paikakariki so far, and
the roads of national significance.
Yeah, and when Transmission Gully's done, it'll just shift to the terrace tunnel. But I would say, you know, more broadly, outside of transport, New Zealand actually doesn't have a bedroom crisis. We have a housing crisis. We have plenty of bedrooms for everyone to live in. We just don't use our housing stock very efficiently, and nor do we use our land very efficiently. People are land banking and have every incentive to do so under the current tax system. So I think if you get the tax system right, you'll have an incentive to densify as well, far more than we have now.
I think one of the things that we've been talking about is looking at rail, looking at linking up some of those population centres so we can make it easier for people to travel between them for work, leisure, and for thinking about family connections too, just thinking about what Julianne was saying. Because I think it's the totality of life that we need to be taking into account here, not just about work, but also how we plan for life in New Zealand in general.
Thank you. I think Susan had a question.
I want to ask if your parties have thought about how we can make better use of immigrant, and that will include refugee skills that they bring into the country. Because when I'm in a taxi with someone who is obviously an immigrant into the country, I have to stop myself asking them if perhaps they might be a brain surgeon, you know, because, and I hear how expensive it is to retrain or whatever they have to do, upgrade, upskill, whatever. And just the other day we had a really interesting person come to talk, and he wants to do extra study, but at the moment can't afford to. He wants to start an Arabic-speaking tourist company. I think that would be a great thing to have in New Zealand, but he can't get the money. So have your parties thought about how there can be some extra help that's more than a student loan, which then burdens them with debt, because the investment would surely give us a lot of payback?
Sir, would you mind responding to that first?
I'm not aware of anything in particular that I can speak to. There probably is, but I can speak of my experience with organisations like Pomegranate Kitchen here in Wellington. You know, working really closely with those communities that have skills that they can offer and use them to provide lunches for everyone in Wellington. I think there are so many opportunities. I have similar conversations with people. So I think we can be more imaginative and thinking very carefully around credentialing, where people can bring their previous learning and use that here in this context, and how it was that we can enable them to set that knowledge and skill base free in New Zealand, in a New Zealand context. I think we could be doing much, much more in that space.
Jeff, would you mind? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not just migrants. We're entering a new phase of the economy where people are going to, you know, industries are going to be destroyed. People are going to have to constantly retrain several times through their lives. What work they do get is going to be sporadic, the gig economy. That's why we favour a move to an unconditional basic income, so people have a level of support. They don't have to go knocking on Windsor's door. They don't have to worry about witch hunt welfare. They can use that to retrain, to start a business, do whatever they need to do to pursue their passion. So I think long term we're all going to be in exactly this position. We need an unconditional basic income, and to pay for it we need to tax assets.
Chris Van
Lathan. Oh, look, I fully understand the question and agree with you. There's nothing sadder than talking to a taxi driver who hypothetically comes from Eritrea, trained as a doctor. I know from my previous life in the Law Society, there was a committee I was on that a foreign, I'm not saying we need more lawyers, but if a foreign lawyer was coming in, what further training did they need, and proof of where they'd been? And often it's proof of the qualification that's the problem. But I think it's one of the great tragedies that so many people over the years, and I go back to Richard Fuchs, who came in the 30s getting away from Nazism in Dresden, was unable to achieve his potential here because of that particular problem. The issue is that in some countries one can't readily verify what exactly they've been doing, and that they have particular qualifications. I totally share with you the sentiment that if people have those skills, we should, where possible, use them.
Yeah. Can I completely agree with the sentiment of your question? And I think, again, it just comes back to the overall vision of what government is there for. And in my opinion, government's there to protect and empower people. And there are many different ways to do that. But there's a really important role in ensuring that we're investing in public goods like education, opportunities for people, whether it's through a UBI. And there's a really important role for ensuring that that the tax system is fair. And that over the last 30 years, we've had a slow kind of erosion of public services and infrastructure in order to provide tax cuts for the wealthiest people, and we need to reverse that.
Thank you. And I think we've probably got time for just one more question if we have just have brief answers, but actually I'm sorry, I think this gentleman here actually asked a question first. If I come over here, we'll just bring a microphone to you.
Thank you. On this little leaflet about tonight, it says, uncover the facts, and facts is underlined in red. I'm wondering whether we really need to know more about ourselves than we've been hearing tonight. So often we hear about capital gain and the economy's growing, but all it really measures is the flow of money. It doesn't say whether it's good, bad, or whether it affects the environment or anything else. So I'd suggest for a start we need better measurements, and one known already is called Genuine Progress Index, or GPI.
Can I just interrupt and ask what your question is, because we're almost running out of time. What would you like to ask the panel?
So my question is, should we have better measurements? Do we need to know ourselves a lot better than we currently do? And that hasn't come out of the meeting, in my view, tonight. There's a whole lot more we need to know about ourselves. Perhaps we need to come up with better systems of measurement.
I'll put the question. Chris Finlayson, do we need to know ourselves better and come up with different ways of measuring?
Gee, I'm not the Minister of Statistics. I'm the humble Minister of Treaty Negotiations. Oh, I'm sure that there are always better ways of looking at things. I haven't really turned my mind to it.
Yes, absolutely. We need to measure progress in a better way. I'm not a great fan of the GPI. I think because you have to make so many assumptions to come up with a single number. One single number is always flawed because there are so many value judgments made. I think we have to agree, 10 or so things that we all really value and measure them, and they should be up there every year.
Should we ask Julia?
That's why we need a basket, I think.
Yeah, measuring things differently is at the core of Green Party policy, and I would say at the core of Green Party economic policy, but again, I think it's a bit silly to separate out people from the economy and the environment. So, and we have a specific bill called the Sustainability Indicators Bill, which sets out a framework. I know that Treasury is currently working with the Living Standards Framework, but it's not been elevated to a status where it could really be instrumental in driving government policy. But it's there, so it could be if we had a government with the political will.
I know that we've certainly committed to looking at the Public Finance Act and looking to see how we measure progress. So it's not just about economic indicators, but broadening that out to a wider range of indicators which summarise how well we can know ourselves as New Zealanders, as a nation, and how we're moving forward on the things that we regard as important. I know that we want to have a discussion, and our intention is to alter the Public Finance Act to take account of that discussion.
Thank you very much. Look, I'm sorry we've run out of time, everybody, but I'd just like to thank our panellists tonight, Saab Juhal, Julianne Genter, Jeff Simmons and Chris Finlayson. Thank you very much for your time and your contributions, and of course thank you to you all for coming to listen tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Derek Woodard-Layman on behalf of the University of Otago, on behalf of our Department of Theology and Religion, and on behalf of our Center for Theology and Public Issues. Thank you all for coming tonight and for participating in this part of our political process. And please join me in thanking again our moderator and our panelists for making themselves available. Although this concludes our series of programs leading up to the election, we will have other things on, and if you take the little card on your seat or the seat next to you and check our website, you can find information about things coming up in the next few weeks, including a symposium next week on responses to violence against women in the Pacific that's put on in partnership with the University Centre and the New Zealand Partnership for Pacific Initiative. So I hope to see you next week, and thank you again. Good night.